Podcasters are exceptional people. They survive trolls. They survive total rickrolling. They bear all the sins of the internet. They give themselves up. They transcend themselves. They are transfigured into a viral phenomenon known as the Last Knock.
That was good and creepy there, Johnny.
I would have said it in French, but I don't know how to say that in French. So
we
you have to deal with the English translation on that one. So
yeah.
In any case, tonight, actually, okay, first of all, I am Johnny Mademoiselle Num. And joining me tonight is
Billy the Martyr Crash.
Very good. I was gonna say you're Etienne, actually.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna do that.
Oh, okay. Is everything okay in there, Etienne? Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's just awesome.
But in any case, tonight we are discussing Pascal Laugier's 2008 film, Martyrs.
10th anniversary.
Absolutely, and congratulations. Congratulations are in order, for sure.
What those actresses went through, holy hell.
Oh, yeah, and we'll definitely get into that. But it's definitely a lot to talk about with this film, and I know we've mentioned it periodically throughout our tenure with this podcast, so obviously there's something more to it, and hopefully we get to go into a little more depth and detail with the conversation than we have up to this point. But Billy, before we get into the meat and the definite meat of the matter tonight, you have a Crash Palace Productions / Last Knock announcement you would like to make. So have at it.
All right. Well, as you know, Johnny and I have been doing the show for 5 years, and we're not going anywhere yet. But we are cutting back a little bit, and we're going to change things a little bit. The show will now, instead of being every Sunday, it'll be every other Sunday. So it's going to be a bi-weekly podcast. And so on those Sundays we're not doing a show, there will be a horror-related article posted for your reading enjoyment, either from me or Johnny, and or hopefully some of the other wonderful souls who've written for us in the past, and we'll do so again. And if you have any horror-related writing that you would like to see appear on Crash Palace, let me know. I highly recommend that you look at maybe a review or an article from our own Johnny Num. And if you could, you don't have to mimic him, but if you could write at that level, you're in. If you can't, don't even send it to me. Really, I'm serious. Don't send it to me. Please don't waste my time. Bill, can you publish this? And I read it, and they're like, no, man. Please don't make me tell you something shit. You know. So, I'm being honest.
Well, and that's good, Bill. And actually, I was going to say, if anybody wants to reach out to me in that regard as well, I can pass things along to Bill. I can act as a conduit. So.
Wow, it's like a X-Files episode.
I was going to say, that's going to be the sequel to Martyrs, Bill, The Conduit.
Wow. I hope there's no sequel to Martyrs.
Well, there was a remake, but yeah, we don't have to talk about that.
That was Pascal Laugier's fault, because he made the deal with Hollywood. I mean, he wrote and directed this, and he's the one who put that deal in motion. And one of the issues, I think, with the film, and I haven't seen the remake, and I don't want to, was the budget was severely cut, and that's why the one director bailed on it.
For the remake, you mean?
Yeah, for the remake.
Oh, okay, because I know it was a troubled film, as are a lot of films that are, well, I should say, were under the banner of the Weinstein Company.
And plus, when Hollywood wants to take a film like this, which is, as far as I'm concerned, it's one of the greatest horror films ever made, and it set a whole new standard for horror, which nobody has really lived up to since then. Hollywood's going to take it, and they're going to make a commercial film out of it almost. Like, you can't do that. Not this. I mean, Pascal had trouble making this in France. The only one who came to his rescue, so to speak, because all the French studios turned him down, was Canal Plus, because they are edgy. They do cool stuff. I mean, look at any David Lynch film. Guess who's there, you know?
Yeah,
So they'll do new, edgy, bizarre, even hard, you know, very horrific stuff that pushes the edge, so to speak. So he had a tough time. So I'm sure when a Weinstein company, and I use their name with some disdain, got a hold of this, you know, they did, you know, I don't know what they were thinking. I don't know what anyone was thinking in Hollywood. Yeah, we'll make it. No, I don't know why.
Well, you know what, Bill, I will say this. The fact that it got a wide distribution on home video meant I could walk into my local Best Buy and blind buy a copy of this, which is exactly what I did when it came out on DVD.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because sadly, for whatever reason, I don't know, apparently the Blu-ray, Region 1 Blu-ray for Martyrs is no longer available.
I didn't know that they ever had a Blu-ray for it in North America.
Yeah, it must have been short-lived. I don't know if their 10th anniversary, you know, is coming out for this, but I hope so.
Criterion, are you listening?
Oh, man, this should definitely be a Criterion film, yeah. yeah. We haven't even talked about it. Nobody knows what we're talking about, but, you know.
Yeah, and I guess now's as good a time as any to paste up the spoiler alert for this film.
Yeah.
Because Billy and I were talking, we could maybe talk about the first half of the film without giving anything away, but then there's a whole other half that we couldn't talk about. So now that that's issued, if you haven't seen the film, search for it on Netflix or Amazon or wherever and give it a look-see if you're so inclined. And then return to our show and listen also if you are so inclined.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Netflix. That's where I first saw it. And okay. I didn't hear much about it. You know what I mean? Like, I went into it like cold and blind, and I was just knocked on my ass. You know, there started to be rumbles from people, you know? And it was sort of subversive in how it captured the attention of the horror community.
Yeah, so you didn't really know a whole lot about it then, Bill.
No, and like every movie I watch, I don't want to see a trailer. I don't want to hear anything about it. I don't want anyone coming, this won't spoil the movie for you, but no, don't tell me anything. You know, it's like, I don't even want to know who's in it, you know?
You know, even that tiny stuff can plant that seed and it can go wild, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, as George Costanza's father said on Seinfeld, I want to go in fresh! So that's me, man, you know? And, but I just think this movie, we're going to obviously talk about the film, but I think we need to talk more about the elements of the film that don't exist in horror movies, that need to exist in horror movies to make them horror, and as well. So we'll get there.
Well, and you know, Bill, you know, I think my experience was similar to yours, since we're kind of talking about how we first encountered the movie. I feel like back around that time, about 10 years ago, I think Dread Central was kind of my go-to horror site.
Yeah, Dread Central's fantastic.
Yeah, and they're still good. And I feel like that's where I was hearing about Martyrs, but it was mostly from their podcast and more from like festival reporting. I wasn't hearing much about it as, you know, I was hearing some probably distribution news, and I think I must have known something about it coming out on DVD because I went into Best Buy to buy that movie. So,
gotcha.
But otherwise, I don't think I was reading a lot. I was hearing a lot of people kind of start to talk it up who had seen it, but it was kind of like, you know, it was like it's not getting released in the States, theatrically. It's just kind of doing the festival run, so you kind of got to wait for home video. And I'm kind of like you, Bill. I didn't really know much either, and I was kind of really surprised and really kind of pummeled and simultaneously floored by the film. So,
yeah, pummeled's a good word, man.
Oh yeah, I rewatched it again this week in preparation for this show, and my God, it every time.
Yeah, And this was written, as we said, by Pascal Laugé, and he wrote this during a time where he was depressed.
No shit.
Yeah, I know. I think this adds to the element of nihilism that you could feel throughout. And man, I'm talking about nihilism in its most nihilistic form.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, what? How would you break the plot? Break the plot down, Bill.
Man. Two young women. Two young women. They're lovers. They've one has suffered untold physical abuse, and she goes out for revenge, and something even worse happens. That's the simplest, I think, the simplest way to put it.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. That's good, Bill.
Thank you, thank you.
Leave them wanting more.
Yeah, before the spoilers come.
Yeah, and I guess the film starts off, and it's really jarring, I think, you know, because it starts off with young Lucy, and she's in a warehouse. She's been abused, and well, she's being abused.
The former slaughterhouse.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay.
Abattoir. Right.
Ah, that's symbolic. Yeah.
White.
And she manages to escape her tormentors, and you know, the opening credits are done over, like, it seems like this Super 8 footage of her in I guess an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's really interesting how Laugier kind of just builds the relationship between Lucy and Anna.
Right.
You know, and Anna is kind of this, she's a child, but she's mature, because she actually says at one point, oh, she has nobody, I got to take care of her.
Mm-hmm.
And right. That kind of informs the rest of the film.
Yep. Pretty much.
So what did you think about that setup, Bill? Did you think it was, I think to me it really built a lot of intrigue, and then the film kind of does a hard right turn after that opening credits sequence too.
Yeah, it did, you know, because I first thought, oh man, is this going to be some sort of home invasion movie? And then it's like, oh, and then it's like, oh my gosh, something else, you know, it's just like, you know, Pascal starts, you know, punching us in the head with like rapid changes, like you said, a hard right turn, things we didn't expect. And it was awesome. It was a great setup, because that opening is different from the first act, and the first act is different from the rest. And that's fantastic. Yet it's seamless, and it makes sense. It's a really well-crafted story.
Where did you have any notion of where the film might be going, Bill, when it cuts to 15 years later?
No, I didn't, and that was the beauty of it. Because sometimes, I mean, you get settled in, and there's these formulaic expectations that come with a very trope-filled genre like horror. And so I was like, you know, I knew the acting was good, it was wonderful, the cinematography was excellent, the music, I mean, everything was there. So I was like, well, and, you know, it's French, and I know, you know, I had a pretty good idea that they weren't going to take, take like the road often traveled. And, you know, I had seen Pascal's other films, The Tall Man, which was quite wonderful, based on that mythos. And Saint Ange, which I didn't really appreciate, but that was his like first feature.
Okay.
But I knew there was something there with this guy, and man, did he prove it! So.
Because I kind of like the banality, I guess, of the sequence with the family.
Yes.
In that isolated, very wealthy, well-off looking home that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this like chaotic scene around a breakfast table, and there's a lot of tight close. Yeah, there's a lot of tight close-ups. There's a lot of quick cutting from person to person, and you really get like within the span of a few minutes kind of a feel for this family.
Yep.
And then you wonder how they factor into things, and then essentially this whole like bland domestic scene turns into a slaughterhouse. Like.
Yep.
where we started in the film.
Exactly. Very unexpected, and when it happens, it's extremely brutal. I mean, the special effects in this film, the special makeup effects are first rate, awesome. As I've said before, after watching Inside, I think the French use real blood in their films because it's like really awesome. And that's the thing, like, you know, for like gore hounds, this is really truly amazing work. And I'm sure some people would say, yeah, well, this movie was gorier, this and that. But you have to keep it in perspective in regard to, like, this is a dramatic horror film. It's serious. It's a serious film. And they don't pull punches, and they don't make jokes. If there's a comedic line in this movie, there isn't. So don't even look for one. It's real traumatic. And the gore in this, the bloodshed in this, just adds to that that horror, that terror, that serious nightmare that it creates.
Yeah, Bill, and I totally agree with you. I think there is a distinction to be made, though, with Martyrs, because, like you said, Pascal Laugier was depressed when he wrote the film, and how it's kind of interesting that sometimes when horror films go the full serious route, there winds up being like unintentional comedy or comedy that bubbles to the surface because people are looking for an out from all the, you know, the carnage or the pain that's going on. And, you know, while you watch Martyrs, you're like kind of, it gets you in a chokehold and you don't laugh, you know, you don't even nervous laugh at anything because there's nothing to nervous laugh at in this film, you know, period. And I think that's kind of what separates it from like a Friday the 13th sequel where people are just watching for the fun of the body count and the kills.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, exactly. It's a totally different approach to making a horror film because these characters are tormented. They're in literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. they're in pain. Like when Lucy enters that family's home with a shotgun and essentially kills, you know, she kills everybody. She's like crying at certain points. And you're like wondering what is, you know, first of all, you're wondering, okay, why is she doing this? And then it's like, why is she crying over what she's doing?
Exactly.
What is the reason for that? And again, that's something that develops as the film goes along. You get a better, slightly better idea of why, what's going on inside her head.
Yeah, and the whole film's about pain. And apparently, I don't know if this is true, and I sort of hope it isn't, because the movie I'm going to refer to is absolutely awful. And I know it's loved by many, and I don't know why, because it's pure and adulterated shit. And that is Hostel. And apparently, Pascal Laugier had been inspired by Hostel, but instead of wanting to show people suffer, he wanted to show people in pain.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because Hostel's just empty. It's just an empty piece of crap.
Well, it's just Eli Roth pressing the gore joy buzzer every couple minutes. It's more pathetic than anything, I think. Because he's like sitting off camera, and you're just getting the impression from what he's doing that it's like, hey, look at me, hey, check this out, isn't it awesome? Isn't it cool? You know?
Yeah. And it's such a joke, it doesn't resonate at all because you're like this. It's so fantastical. But Pascal works really hard to make sure, like, imagine this is real, and that's what sets it apart.
Yeah, and what did you think of, because he wrote and directed this film, Bill, what did you think of the writing, like the script element of the film?
Script-wise, I think it's something that every independent filmmaker should look at before they make a movie, especially in horror. Yeah, we're going to make a horror movie. It's going to be awesome. No, it's not going to be awesome. And you're deluding yourself. And, you know, we need to read scripts anyway. But when you check out that script and see how tight it is, how it creates an atmosphere that is unyielding, mm-hmm. that's totally captivating. And just completely hard to ignore. It's a solid story. Absolutely solid.
And you know, Bill, something interesting that the last time I watched this, that it reminded me of in terms of a storytelling or structural, I should say, angle, is it reminded me of I told you I watched Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance recently.
Yes. Excellent Chan Wook Park film.
And something that Chan Wook Park really does that's keeps his stuff very interesting and keeps you on your toes is, like I said to you, at about the hour point in that film, a couple things happen in quick succession and you're totally spun around.
Yeah.
On what, where you thought the film was going, who the protagonist is, who the villain is in that film. Yep. It's really awesome. And I love that. But that's something that I'm like, holy shit, you got mad skills, man, because you brought it all around in the end, too.
Absolutely. And, man, you know, that's an epic film. And, you know, I love Old Boy and I love everything. Chan Wook Park's one of my favorite directors.
But, Stoker,
yeah,
Thirst.
Stoker and all. And to me, that's my favorite film of his. That just blew me away for its layers. And this film, you know, Pascal Lage did the same thing. Martyrs has layers to it. It has depth. It has soul. It has unexpected elements. And it doesn't even have to be like a plot twist. It could be like you were saying when, you know, Anna, you know, she's blowing people away and she's...
Lucy.
I knew I'd fuck it up.
It's okay.
You know, Lucy's blowing people away and she's crying about it, you know, and the whole thing. Why? Why the contrast? Why not either be, you know, like, and this is what separates it from stupid slasher films, and they are stupid. There's only three that I really hold in high regard, that all the rest of the slashers come from. And I'm going to tell you what they are right now. That's Black Christmas.
Nice.
Yes. That, to me, that set everything in motion. And I respect it. I don't appreciate it like other people do. Maybe I saw it too late in life, but the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because I know what that did. And actually, what one person, I don't remember the person's name, but they said it beautifully, and I'm quoting them. The filet mignon of slasher films, which was my Bloody Valentine.
Oh, wow.
You know, which is really a wonderful film. But other than that, it's the same shtick. Over and over, it's the same, you know, territory. We're starting to see a couple of new films that are a little bit different, you know, with that subgenre. But you know, and I you know, this movie, you know, it does have its gore element, but that's not what it's about.
Yeah, and I think an important distinction, another distinction to make, Bill, is that, like we said, Laguiller does not. For as violent as this film is, he does not sensationalize the violence. He makes the violence actually really ugly. Whereas, you know, you watch something, and I think, you know, I know you don't like this movie, but I do. Uh-oh. You know, I think like something like The Devil's Rejects, which is extremely violent. I think it presents the violence in a, not in a similar manner, but just in a way that's just very kind of in your face, unavoidable, intense, even though the characters are in it. Yeah, exactly. And that's what you got with Martyrs. And something I liked, which he did, was, you know, during the violent moments, he would actually go from like a smooth gliding camera to something that's more rough and shook up kind of, you know, but he doesn't overdo it. He does it just enough to like jar you kind of, you know, and it kind of adds to the intensity as characters are moving in the frame and, you know, shots are being fired or what have you kind of, it's very intense. It's very kind of guerrilla style in the moment. Yeah.
And that's, I'm glad you said that because this isn't exploitive at all. You know, this isn't about naked women being hunted or any crap like that. You know, there is, I remember calling it, when I first saw it, I was like, it's torture porn with a philosophy. And, And it's even beyond that, because labeling it as torture porn sets up a whole bunch of different ideas in people's heads. And that is hostile, but that is torture porn. But you know, it's that element of philosophy, that thematic depth that's interwoven, that is the total foundation for this entire movie. And it's it just makes it even more frightening.
Yeah, I agree, Bill. And the interesting thing is that we, you know, like I said, we're being caught off guard with kind of each real shift in the film.
Yeah.
And or real change. And when we get to the a certain point, it's about halfway through, I think, where it's like you're kind of wondering where it's going, and yeah. then something seems to come out of fucking nowhere, you know, and we're introduced to this new set of characters, including Mademoiselle, played by Catherine Begin,
who we lost only a few years ago.
Oh, I didn't know she passed.
Yeah, she passed. Yeah.
Oh, that's terrible. Go ahead.
Well, she's been, you know, she was born in 1939, you know, and you know, so yeah.
You know, in her performance and in her just her appearance, you know, she really left quite an impression. But
she really did. What a way to, like, pretty much. I wouldn't. Was it her last film? No, it wasn't her last film. But you know, it was because she passed in 2013, but. You know, a good way to close out her career with such a poignant, intense, unexpected role. You know, it's like,
yeah,
you know.
Well, and that's the point where Laugier kind of he shifts the film again by giving us it's a couple minute monologue that Mademoiselle has.
Yes,
and she's like laying everything. She's essentially laying everything out. This is what we're doing. This, you know, it's true. Lucy was being tortured, you know, as a child. It wasn't her imagination.
Right.
You know, she kind of validates and verifies these things for Anna, who's kind of sitting there handcuffed to a table. And she then gives this whole philosophical thing about, martyrdom.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you think of that that monologue, that whole sequence, Bill, that takes place in a secret corridor beneath the house? Yeah.
Well, you know, what I love about it again is, you know, Pascal Laugier wrote something that is you know, something that you normally wouldn't want to do. You wouldn't want to have such intense exposition or anything like that. But he, again, did it differently to make it work. And I think and it was really excellent, because at that point in the film when it happened, I'm like, you know, I need some sort of answers. I need some sort of, like, framework around this shit. And I felt like she was speaking directly to me.
Yeah.
And so when Mademoiselle's talking, I'm listening, and I'm like, oh, now I get what's happening to me. And this is really fucked up. Because, you know, she's and it's cool because she's not part of a secret society. She's part of a secret philosophical society. And that's more dangerous than anything. If there's a philosophy, then that lays down a whole bunch of elements that you have people towing the line, making this work, and it's just insane.
Bill, I'm thinking about the lunch scene between Marcia and Max Wren in Videodrome. It has something you don't, Max. It has a philosophy, and that is what makes it dangerous.
Exactly. Yes. nothing like a little Videodrome.
Yeah, exposure to Videodrome signal could have a similar effect as watching Martyrs, actually. So.
Yep.
But you know what, Bill? I'm with you. I think Laugier took a lot of risks with in terms of structure, in terms of the execution, no pun intended, of the film, and especially in terms of how he told the story. Like you're saying, he made all these unconventional choices that really paid off and led to something really special. Obviously, we're still talking about it more people than us are still talking about this film and bringing up what a bruising experience it is. What did you... So did you feel that the... Did you feel that the violence in the film, Bill, was justified? Was it ever over the top or excessive to you?
No, never. No, on the one hand, yeah, it is over the top and excessive. But when you take that philosophy into account, it needs to be. I mean, the philosophy justified the story. And that's just really frightening. My only question would be to this group, if they existed, was, well, why instead of, why don't you ask for volunteers?
Bill, I felt there was kind of an interesting, and this popped into my head the last time I watched it, the catalyst that gets the Legend of Hell House going?
Yes.
Is this old, newspaper magnate who wants to, he Rossi. Essentially, yeah, well, Deutsch is the old man's name. Belasco is the guy who was in Hell House, But he essentially wants to know, hey, he's getting old. He knows he's going to die soon. He wants verification of life after death.
Yes.
He wants that proven. And that's kind of what to a certain extent, the people who are part of this philosophical cult, as you put it, want the same kind of thing. And you notice when they all pull up at the end of the film in their cars, I believe the film is taking place in the mid-80s.
Right, it does, because it's the initial stuff is 71, and it's 15 years later, so 86.
Yeah, and I think what's kind of interesting is that all of the people who are part of this cult, they're on the old side, so they're these obviously rich people who are holding out for that bit of reassurance that, if they can't take it with them, are they going to go someplace at least?
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of the key age-old questions. Once we understand that we're mortal, all right, what happens after we die? Is this it? Because other people are hoping for something a lot better than the way they were treated on this planet, and these people had the ways and means to try and find an answer in that nether region, that zone. That slim zone that exists between life and death. And we've heard stories, people with near death experiences. I know a doctor even wrote a book on he said, you don't understand, these people were brain dead, yet they had visions, So if they're brain dead, how can they have a vision, how can a blind man describe everything that he saw when he was above his body in the operating room? How can that happen? So it's do we have a soul? That one guy it was in the 1890s in the United States, he weighed people at the moment of death, how many grams? Was it 16 grams?
It's 21 grams.
21 grams, yeah.
They made a movie.
The movie of it. And of course those experiments haven't been done since, but, so what leaves the body? Was it the soul? Does it have weight? Are we going to transcend our own lives and live again? If you're a Buddhist, you have no soul. But if you're not a Buddhist, pretty much every religion I know of is yes, you're going to be rewarded for your life on earth, hopefully, if you're a good person, in heaven, if not in a type of hell. And these people want to know, does something exist?
Yeah, exactly. And Bill, for the first time, I was back when I still had my Shudder subscription, I watched the original Flatliners.
Oh, awful film.
And you know what? No, it could have been great, but it had a couple problems.
Had a lot of problems.
And I'm not going to get into them. Part of the problem was Joel Schumacher, but also part of the problem was that script, because the script doubles down on all the interesting possible angles it could have explored. And I don't know if there was studio meddling or what, but in any case, I was like, here you have this awesome concept and you boil it down to the most generic parable about forgiveness and redemption possible. Whereas Martyrs is kind of like the, uh, if you don't like Flatliners, watch Martyrs, because it actually goes to those places that Flatliners was afraid to go to, but people might be pissed off with Martyrs because you don't get those blunt answers that knock you over the head, kind of.
Yeah.
Philosophically speaking, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So.
True. Yeah, but this is one of the most well-measured horror stories I'd ever witnessed.
Bill, what did you think about the relationship between Anna, played by Morgana Alloway, thank you, and Lucy, played by Mylène Jean-Panoy?
Well, first of all, as you can imagine, Pascal Laugier, besides getting funding for the film, getting a studio to back him, he had trouble getting actresses for this thing.
And, yeah.
And he said, you know, one of the main problems was, you know, beyond the special effects and all, was like they pretty much had to cry all the damn time. And, I mean, that takes a lot out of you. And they definitely did that. As actresses, I thought they were amazing and stellar, and they gave it their all. And as characters in the film, it's a sobering relationship, you know, knowing what they came from, what they're enduring, and where they're going, you know. And it's just really awful, you know, this doomed love, you know.
Well, and I think something that I think is interesting about the Anna character is that, you know, she's kind of a silent partner for a time, and then she becomes complicit, I guess, out of necessity, because she still feels in that position where she has to take care of her friend.
Yeah, exactly.
So she's at the ready when Lucy calls her saying, you know, oh, I found them. I found the people who were torturing me. And she starts to help clean up the mess, though she's conflicted, because at one point we see that the mother has survived her gunshot wound. You know, there's all these things where she's like, oh, well, what do I do? Do I defy my friend? Or, you know, because you can see this internal struggle going on with the two of them, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
With their interpersonal relationship, and just with their own processing of the situation itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's part of the suffering. It's part of that theme. You know, they're suffering with their choices, suffering with the decisions they have to make, suffering with the actions they have to take. And, you know, it's just, it's endless. It's nihilistic. So.
And, you know, Bill, something I got to point out that I liked about this film is that you don't have some stupid, annoying subplot about someone calling in the police or something like that. You don't have the stupid moment where the stupid local cop comes by to see what's happening because someone nearby called the cops.
Yeah, yes, I am Inspector Clouseau, and forget it. But anyway, you know, it's like, you know,
Baguette, yeah.
I always hate that. Every time I see a cop show up in a movie now, I'm just a cop or a priest. It's like, get them out of there. Get them the fuck out of my movie, and let's do something different, man.
The best recent use of a cop in a recent movie is the guy Jimmy from the two John Wick films.
Oh, okay, all right, that's cool.
Yeah, because he kind of knows John's background, so he just comes by and says, "Oh, we heard some neighbor heard some noise. Everything okay?" And John Wick's like, he's got blood on his face, and he's like, "Yeah, everything's okay." It's like, well, yeah. I'll just leave you to it then. Have a good night.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jimmy. Yeah. But, you know, to bring up another aspect that I kind of liked, and I was wondering what you thought of this, Bill, is the mysterious, severely scarred woman who's
listed as the creature in the credits.
Yes, who shows up periodically, usually after Lucy has committed some act of violence.
Yeah, Isabel Chassé played the part. That's something else. It's almost like they gave up on her because she reached a point where it's like she just can't even enunciate anything. So she's like some weird failed experiment.
No, Bill, I'm talking about the...
Who are we talking about?
I'm talking about, I'm talking about the other one.
The other one?
There's two scarred women. Anna discovers the one down in the secret passageway.
Yeah.
But then there's the other one who only Lucy can seem to see.
Oh.
The one who starts she gets a straight razor and apparently starts slashing up Lucy. After Lucy does something violent, this scarred creature seems to come out of the ether and do something violent in turn to Lucy. Yeah. And then it turns out this is a figment of Lucy's imagination. It's a manifestation of guilt, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, then there's nothing else to say, man. You just said it.
Okay, no, I just thought that was interesting because every time I watch the movie, granted I don't watch it often, I'm like always trying to piece together what is the deal with the scarred woman who seems to move in fast motion, kind of. So, but yeah. you're talking about the other one who's kind of like a corollary to that imaginary character.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And they both serve the film, obviously. What I was saying about Ms. Chassay, her character is like this, like they were reaching a point and they maybe weren't doing it right. Like now, like with Lucy and all, they have it down to a true science of what they could do to maybe capture that, keep that person in that moment between that extreme moment between life and death. And I think also with Lucy, she's so mentally damaged from what happened in her childhood that, I can imagine her conjuring all sorts of things, and maybe it's to a degree her way of maybe saying to herself, "Yeah, I deserve this. I deserve what's coming to me," because she's just so she's been emotionally raped, as well as physically abused, and I don't know.
Well, and yeah, like I said, when we discover that this creature is, that the Lucy's demon, I guess you could say,
yeah,
is just a demon, and she's actually cutting away at herself, mm-hmm. as she's imagining the demon cutting away at her.
Yeah,
it is very profound, and that's a really good point, Bill. It's like another manifestation of guilt. It's like she can't get. It's like a symbol or a indication that she still has that baggage, and she even says at one point, she makes a plea to this demon of her mind saying, I did this.
Yeah.
And, I shouldn't, but she can't rid herself of it. That's kind of the tragedy of her character.
Yeah. Guilt and shame are tertiary feelings that, real people have, because some people, don't have that depth. And, she has that for all we know. She could have blamed herself for the abuse that she received and as a young girl. And part of the thing, too, with her crying, when she's committing, when she's taking that abusive family out, is that whole, she does, like, I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't have to do this. It's wrong. But mm-hmm. I know no other way out. And I think it was also, she was sick, like, as she was committing the acts of murder, it wasn't bringing her any satisfaction.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you can actually say she was already dead.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think another thing that separates this film from, a revenge film, just like a conventional revenge film, is that a lot of times revenge movies really play up kind of the hand-wringing catharsis of the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like you're waiting for that, you're waiting for the rapists to get their just desserts and kind of cheer over it. Whereas
sit on your grave.
Exactly. And it's a bit different here because, like you said, there's kind of that hollowing out of, you know, the you know, this character wants to move on. She wants to get past this, but she can't. And that's probably the grim reality of that situation. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up I Spit on Your Grave, because
you brought it up, Bill.
I did? Well, you were mentioning, I mean, what movie, you know, I mean, talking about the rape, you know, waiting to see the rapist get theirs. I'm always going right back to I Spit on Your Grave. The interesting thing was, first Scream 2 was on Twitter talking about it a little bit, about its exploitation. And I was talking about how it's an anti-exploitation film, you know. If we were going to have an argument over it, it'd be a fun one, I think. But, and I think that wasn't exploitive either. I think that presented something, again, really horrible. And we have these people being removed from the planet one by one, at they're not the victim, but the survivor. And I remember cheering like a madman watching that movie for Camille Keaton, you know, doing her bit. And in this one, though, I just felt sad and awful.
The interesting thing is, you know, Camille Keaton in that film is putting on she's kind of putting on a mask as she seduces these men.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, who've raped her. And, you know, at the end, there's kind of like this brief intimation of a smile, and then it quickly goes back to this really stern, stoic face, like she's forever changed by what they've done to her and what she's done to them, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, you know, well, we all react differently to trauma, and it's, you know, you can't really predict how you're going to react to trauma and whatnot, and what people do or don't do, and how they suffer or don't suffer, or mask it or not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this film, it's interesting. It's not, well, it's just sad that you've a character that's torn, and then at the end, just like, you know, she succumbs to her fate, because I think she feels like she deserves it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would agree with that. I would agree with that, Bill.
Which adds to the horror.
And you know what? A theme that really kind of stood out at me the last time I watched it, and I don't know why it didn't occur to me before, given the structure and some of the stuff that happens, is that of kind of mirroring. Mm-hmm. 'Cause, you know, right from the start, when we see young Lucy in the orphanage and she's in her bed, it's lights out, she's scared, she's heard a noise, and she's in bed. She looks under the bed. She sees she sees two legs kind of like going underneath the bed.
Yeah.
And what she does is she kind of does the same thing. She huddles near the headboard of the bed, and then she pulls the covers up. When she pulls the covers down, there is the creature whoever, this shadow demon,
mm-hmm.
right at the foot of the bed, ostensibly staring right back at her, which is like a kind of a mirror image in a way. But then you have her demon, and then you have her demon matched by the creature that Anna takes out of the basement and tries to help.
Right.
The scarred woman who's feels like she thinks she has cockroaches crawling all over her.
Oh yeah.
And then
so medieval.
Yeah, exactly. And then you have, when the plot shifts after Mademoiselle lays out the plot and intent of this cult, it's Anna's turn. It's Anna's turn to be subjected to what Lucy was subjected to.
Yeah.
Only to a much greater extreme.
Yeah, and that's what I hate. Like Chosen, it's like, congratulations, you've won. Oh my God.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Bill. How I wanted to ask you: do you feel like the film is misogynistic in any way?
Wow, that I never even thought of that.
Okay, then. All right.
It.
I think there is an exhibition of strength going on with both of these characters.
Right.
And even the Mademoiselle, for that matter, even the woman who's, you know, who's all scarred up and she's dissociated because she's had her eyes covered and she's been emaciated and everything. I don't know. I just was like, is it or not?
I say no. I think, you know, because the victims are female, and believe it or not, until this moment, that didn't resonate. I guess because it was overshadowed by theme and everything else. But knowing all that women go through around the world, and like, this is one of the things, like, I couldn't be a woman simply because if I got pregnant, I would be freaking out. Usually the strongest people I see or know are women.
Perseverance. Yeah.
Yeah. Perseverance, stronger than men in so many ways. They're, you know, the glue that holds like things together. And it's not that I haven't met like strong men or emotional men who are, you know, wonderful people or anything like that. But, you know, why were the victims all women?
Well, and I mean, there is the Mademoiselle does provide an explanation. I don't think I have the exact line, but it's something about how women are more suited to, and maybe this is something to back up what you're saying, Bill.
I hope so. Before people throw rocks at me.
What she says is something along the lines of young women are more responsive to transfiguration. And so maybe that's an indication that men are incapable of withstanding what it takes to possibly be a martyr in the notion of this this philosophical cult. Like, well, we tried it with guys. They only lasted half as long.
Mm-hmm. And they gave us nothing.
It sounds like, you know, in a weird way, it sounds like not a good thing. It's not really a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe it has to do with maturity levels, too, because she's saying young women. It's like, you know, they're not doing this with older people or anything like that. It's young, healthy women.
And I think she says also follows it up kind of with this off the cuff thing, kind of like, that's just the way it is or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, okay, all right.
And it's funny because she's, you know, she's the queen pin of this philosophical secret society, you know, and she's calling the shots overall, I guess. So.
Yeah. And something else I thought was interesting, Bill, was in the flashbacks to mm-hmm. to Lucy's childhood torture, and also when Anna finds herself chained up in the basement of that house and she's being fed by this woman and she's periodically getting the shit beat out of her by this bulky guy who comes downstairs. I thought it was interesting that you don't get a clear look at any of the faces. I mean, you can kind of see the guy, but the way Laugier cuts around him, he doesn't hold on him too long, so you don't get a really clear look at his face. So what did you think about that? Is that sense of an anonymity and detachment, or is that something that kind of pulls you further into Anna's corner kind of as the film reaches its crescendo?
Oh yeah, man, I'm always in an honest corner. And yeah, that really did remind me of the stories that I, you know, what I studied when I was studying history of the medieval era, where you have torturers and executioners, and that's their profession.
Yeah.
That's a profession. They're trained, they're skilled, this is who they are, this is what they do, they get paid for it, and they go home for dinner. And the element of distance, the emotional distance that they maintained, I was just like, it's freakish and it's horrible. And but it's like at the end of the day, for those guys anyway, it's like, well, it's just my job. And it's just, and it could be, it, you know, by keeping them, you know, that element of anonymity adds to the flavor of fear that the medieval torturers of old, you know, unleashed upon the people that they were torturing.
Yeah, exactly.
In the name, usually in the name of God at that point.
Well, and in some ways, I mean, there is this, I don't know if you'd call it a spiritual inclination that these people mm-hmm. have, you know, because it's like, well, they kind of do want to know.
They have a mission.
They do. They want to know, you know.
Yeah, they have a mission. And if you buy into the mission and the philosophy and all, then you justify your actions and you want to see the end result. You want to be part of that. And that, again, that's horrific.
And I also think it's interesting, Bill, because you look at how young Lucy looked when she escaped the slaughterhouse at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the progression of Anna as, you know, once she's chained up down in that that basement, and then she progressively changes. You know, she becomes emaciated. They cut her hair off.
Mm-hmm.
Her eyes get fused shut. Her mouth looks different.
Yeah.
She's malnourished. She's, I don't know, she just literally turns into this husk of a human being. And it just fascinates me how it's like you see this systematic depreciation and degradation
mm-hmm.
going on in this, in this body.
Yeah.
To the point where it's like she literally becomes unrecognizable, especially, yes. You know, really in that last, holy shit, in that last frame, you know,
man.
With the way she looks. Oh my God.
Can you hear the lawnmower, Johnny?
Yeah, I can.
Son of a bitch. I want to go out there and smack him in the head, but he doesn't know I'm doing a podcast.
Nah, it's not bad. He must be on the far side of the house right now. So
it's right by my window, actually.
Ah, poop.
Sons of bitches.
Well, yeah, so what did you think about that, Bill, just briefly? Because I thought this was another instance of kind of the thematic mirroring that Laugier was utilizing. And Mademoiselle even mentions at one point that the person being tortured starts to see people who aren't there, and that's something that happens to Anna, like it happened to Lucy, who was seeing the scarred up demon creature or whatever.
Right. Well, I mean, you hear strange stories when people are, lack of food, lack of water, lack of sleep.
Deprivation,
you know. Yeah. Yeah, all that deprivation stuff, lack of comfort, you know, your mind does a whole bunch of weird things, sometimes to help you survive, and sometimes because it's a reaction to this negative stimuli. And so it just worked in all the most horrific ways, unlike other movies that might include something bizarre like that, just to have something bizarre happen. You know, this was, the whole movie was as systematic as the group and what they were trying to do. And I, one of the things that I wondered when watching it, and I wonder now, is how many years has this group been in action? How long did it take them to perfect their system to make it work? And who knows how many hundreds of people that they murdered to get to this point.
Yeah, you know, Bill, something interesting, I think during Etienne's address to the cultists at the end of the film, he's saying something like, only four people have reached the state that Anna has achieved, but Anna is the only one to have apparently seen beyond and been able to relay it to the Mademoiselle.
Exactly.
So I'm like, wow.
Like,
wow.
Like, you know, after this, you should be a saint, you know, for real. A real saint. She was the one who steadied herself between both those worlds of the living and the dead, and shared the experience, and it's funny because I remember at the end of the film, like, oh my God, this is so horrible, and I'm like, I remember when she's whispering to Mademoiselle, I remember leaning forward because it's like, I want to know what the answer is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh fuck, I just, like, I'm a sick bastard too. No, you know, but we, I don't know if anybody who doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
You know, what happens beyond and what people want to believe, you know, whatever stories conjured or what about, you know, what the afterlife is. Some people write books on it. Oh, you know, I could see into the future and all, and I'm connected, and I know what one person wrote a book on what heaven's like.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, come on. You know, like, no, you don't. You know, it's like, you know, and I'm not going to spend $16 on your stupid book that tells me. I remember one person got it, was reading it, and they said, well, I was automatically suspicious because they say when you die, you get an ID card and it has to be scanned. And I'm like, okay.
Oh, man. Are you being serious, Bill?
Yeah. I forgot who wrote the book. It was like, and my friend was reading it. And she's like, man, that was such a waste of money. When she started talking about you have an ID scanned, I'm like, forget it, man.
You know what, Bill? It reminds me of that Far Side cartoon where there's this guy who, I guess, he's recently died and he's in hell. And one of Satan's minions has a pitchfork to his back, and there are two doors. One says, damned if you do. The other says, damned if you don't. And the guys and the guy with the pitchfork is saying, come on, come on. It's one or the other.
That's awful.
Well, you know what, Bill? I think since we're kind of wrapping this up, I wanted to share a little bit of feedback from one of our listeners, the wonderful Kim McDonald at Dixie Fairy on Twitter.
Love that woman.
I do. And I made a tweet of the fact that I was watching Martyrs for a podcast, and because I hate myself. So she responded to, and I just kind of asked her what her thoughts on the movie were. And she had this to say, I love the visceral nature of it, something the remake tried to take out of it. I also am fascinated with the idea that only young women are able to achieve martyrdom, torture set against perfect spiritual ascension. And of course, the ambivalence of the ending is perfect. She also said, I would also say the level of violence is not what is most affecting, but also that this is being done by people who believe it has a higher purpose.
Yeah. And that justifies it means to an end.
And you know what I think is interesting, Bill, is that we have the little bit of plot established at the very beginning of the film, but outside of that, most of the plot is relegated to the Mademoiselle's speech and then that last 5 minutes of the film where all those people are gathering, and then it comes full circle, like you said, and it really, you know, if any other film, I don't know that it would have worked as well as it does here. Whatever Pascal was feeling.
It was magic, man. It came. It was given to him by a martyr who transcended.
I can't think of any other way. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of, you know, obviously we're not going to say the line, but one of the absolute greatest end lines to any movie ever outside of horror. You know, just phenomenal to, like, bring it all together in just an absolutely perfect way. It was this whole movie was its own bizarre, ugly, horrific gift. You know, it worked. It was just amazing.
And you know what, Bill? To counter what you were saying about the moment where Anna is whispering to Mademoiselle, my reaction was more, I love the film more for that, because if we would have heard what she was saying, it probably would have been like a Flatliners moment.
It's like,
spell it. Okay, they're going to spell it out because you've survived this film to this point. Yeah. So we're just going to give you a little carrot here. And I'm like, that was really, it was not quite the same, but it was like that moment in Lost in Translation.
Oh, God.
Well, no. Have you seen that one, Bill?
No.
Well, in any case, people who've seen Lost in Translation know what I'm talking about. So, unless, like, my introduction, that was also Lost in Translation. So, do you have any final thoughts on Martyrs, Bill?
Yep, it's a 5-star horror. It's one of the top. I have only a list of like 83 horror films that I think are worthy, and it's one of them, and I would put it in the top 10 for horror. If not, no, forget it, top 3.
Damn.
I have to. It's just so amazing, and it just rips your guts out.
Oh, yeah, that it does.
What about you, Johnny?
You know what? It's a 4 out of 5 for me.
4?
But it's still it's still plenty impact. There, you know, something, and I'm not saying this is the reason, something that I didn't like about the film, and it's probably the only thing I didn't really care for, was the inclusion of a musical score, of all things. I kind of thought it would have been better with no music.
Well, maybe, but it's there, and it didn't make the film depreciate in any way, shape, or form for me.
Oh no, absolutely not. Yeah. I just, you know what, Bill? The other thing is, I'm a really hard scorer, so.
So am I, but.
Well, I.
Oh, you son of a bitch, man! Bastard.
No, I know you are too. So I know that 5 out of 5, because I think you gave Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance a 5, didn't you?
Yeah.
Or Old Boy a 5? I don't know.
Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance I gave 5 stars too, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I just, you know, for whatever reason, this one's a 4. But I mean, a 4 is still plenty good. And I mean, it's definitely a film that's never left my shelf, because as painful as it is to watch, I return to it every couple of years and I'm, you know, taken aback and, you know, kind of enthralled by it in a morbid way. So.
Yeah, I hear you, man. It's something else.
You know, one of the blurbs on the DVD box says it's like a truly unforgettable experience. And I think 10 years in, the fact that we're still using it as kind of the reference point for that period where we were seeing a lot of extreme French horror films, you know, I think that's saying a lot. I think it'll only get stronger as time goes on. So how does that strike you, Bill?
All right, whatever.
Very well. Do you have someone you'd like to, people you'd like to scream out to?
Yes, yes, I do. Angel Damon, depending on how you want to look at it. This person is one of several who are from Twitter land, and the Twitter handle is Blutengel Damon, Daemon. And I know it's Blutengel Damon, aspiring filmmaker, love horror movies, wrestling, and all music, all in capitals.
Nice.
I love to write all capitals. And you can check out Angel Damon at wattpad.com/user/AngelDamon. MB, who's MB? That's Author Fan. And he has a soft spot for what's considered trashy books. And in fact, you could say I'm an expert on the subject, as he is on horror and silly films in 80s miniseries. So that's MB. He's awesome. Check out his blogspot at sleaze-factor.blogspot.com. The wonderful Kimberly Elizabeth, otherwise known as Kimmy, and her handle is Kimmy Kill Zombie, horror
yes.
fiend, hair dye addict, and vegan. And she's the host of the EIC. She's the host slash EIC of Nightmare on Film Street, and that's a wonderful podcast, NOFS podcast. Don't miss that. They're out of Toronto, Ontario. And also check out the website, nofspodcast.com. Gotta love it. Sluts and Guts, and that's N with an N right there. Love watching and discussing bad cult and horror movies. Want to connect with filmmakers, pro, amateur, and indie, and bloggers in those areas. He's out of Chicago. Check out the website, slutsandguts.com. The great, the wonderful, the vivacious Jean Jones. Who's she? One Carolina girl. She's a mom first. She's in the horror, Michael Myers, Halloween, The Walking Dead. She's part of Team Rick, which is coming to an end, apparently this season. And she's in the metal. She's out in South Carolina, and you can follow her on Instagram. And W. Rick's Victory 2. Who's that? Rix, W-R-I-X-2, artist and inventor, created the model of the human thought process as well as fostering many technological breakthroughs. For more, go to rix2.deviantart.com for more. And he's out of Texas. The wonderful, the lovely Tina underscore Scott 95. She's a wife and mother and a Gemini. She's a horror movie fan. She's in the Empire. She's into wrestling as well. Wow, we have a lot of wrestlers today. And she's also on Instagram at Tina underscore Scott 95 as well. And check out her website at tjscotts.soul, S-O-U-L, purpose.net. She's out of the wonderful city, and I am saying that and not as a joke, Detroit, Michigan.
Nice.
Yeah. Maureen Finnerty, who's she? She's Goddess Maureen. And as she says, I am the love goddess. Follow moi to paradise. She writes and acts, and she's currently known for her erotica, which appears to have quite a following, a nice following. She's from California. Check her out. Curious Forgotten Lore. Who's that? That is Lore Curious. And I'm quoting, as I pondered, weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. Note, tweets are comedy slash horror slash history slash folklore fiction by Ganfer Har, H-A-A-R, Finn, two N's. Wild, interesting, cool, bizarre. Love this person's imagination. Check it out. Check out Ganfer's site, or Ganfer's Twitter. And finally, Madame Monstrosity, and that is M-A-D-M Monstrosity on Twitter. She's a glamour ghoul, music fiend, spirit drinker, flesh eater. She's a married mummy and campy retro horror fan. She loves Sven Gulli, and who doesn't? And she embraces the weird and unusual. She's always got a lot of wonderful things on Twitter. Where is she? She's under the full moon. So go there. And Johnny, where can people find you, my friend?
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are still no H's in those Johnnies after 5 years.
Mademoiselle cut them away.
In any case, Billy, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Crash Palace and also at CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this podcast as well as articles. And also, don't forget to check out this show on iTunes. Starred reviews are welcomed, whether it's one or five, as long as they're there. We're happy. And also go to Redbubble.com to the Crash Palace site to get any merchandise if you want. We have Crash Palace and The Last Knock merchandise, so t-shirts, whatever. And I bought my own t-shirt just to see how it would look, and it's really cool, so I'm happy. And
excellent.
Yeah, and the great Paul Belci, who you could find on LinkedIn, B-E-L-C-I. He did the logos. He's a wonderful graphic designer, so check him out and give him some work, damn it. All right, and that's it, Johnny.
Sounds good, Bill. All right.
Then that means we're transcending right now.
Yeah, I know, Bill. Let me make you a martyr.
You can't refuse. Actually, don't make me a martyr. I'll take a martini.
Oh, I'll take a martyr-tini.
I knew that was coming. I was just thinking of that, son of a bitch. Anyway, have a good one, Johnny.
See you, Bill.
All right, bye.